Welcome to the Personal Financial Planning Section podcast, delivering insights from experts on tax, retirement, estate, risk management, investment planning, and practice management, designed to help you best serve your clients and take your practice to the next level. I'm your PFP section host, Sarah Bradley. Be sure to visit us at aicpa.org/PFP and stay tuned at the end of the episode for information on how to access valuable resources. And now over to our guest.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm Steve Siegel, and I'm here to talk about some important issues about basic estate planning, the kinds of core things that we need to be talking to clients about as we are dealing with some very special times. Let's talk about 2020. Let's talk about where we are now and the question of our clients addressing basic planning needs. We've seen so many situations this year where people have died either suddenly, unexpectedly, before they really got core estate planning undertaken. For older folks, maybe they've done their estate planning and maybe what they had worked, made sense, was fine. Not always the case, but more likely than for younger folks. A lot of younger folks who perhaps never did estate planning, thinking, well, they're young, they don't need to be in a rush. So they waited, and then they got sick. Maybe they woke up one day with a cough or a fever, and 2 or 3 days later, they're in the intensive care unit, and sadly, perhaps they passed. What planning was done? Possibly none. What mess is there for their family going forward? Possibly a huge mess. And let's not be entirely dire. Not everyone obviously dies from the pandemic and the issues that have arisen. But people have gotten ill. They've been absent from their homes. They've been absent from their normal lives. Is there someone that has been given the authority to act on their behalf? Do we have a durable power of attorney? If a person is ill and they're in the hospital, is there some type of a living will that's been addressed? So these are the things that we should talk about. And then we should also talk about the fact that many of us are seeing our children go off to college. And in doing so, we're hopeful that they stay safe and healthy. But if they are at college and if they become ill or anywhere traveling and they become ill, what right do we have to gain access to their personal information? There are privacy rules in place in the law that deny our access to that information unless we have some written authority to be given that information. So these are the things let's start talking about. First of all, does your client have a will? Even if you live in a state where a living trust is the centerpiece of estate planning, everyone should have a basic will. If you don't need a living trust, maybe your state is not a probate difficult state, maybe you've chosen just to use a will, that's fine. Make sure you have a current will. Who have you named as your chosen beneficiaries? Who have you named as your fiduciaries? Who is the guardian for your minor children? If we go through clients' lives, these things tend to change. Hopefully they don't have issues with their close family and not wanting to leave them inheritances. But sometimes, for example, they'll choose mom and dad as the executors or trustees under a will. Makes sense. But 20, 30 years go by and mom and dad are older now and maybe they're not around and maybe they're not the right choice even if they are around just because of their age and their inability to step in should they be needed. So take a look at that issue. Should you be naming more of a contemporary, perhaps a younger person, someone who knows your family? And if you have a complicated situation in your life, maybe you have a business that's going to continue. Maybe you have a lot of real estate. Maybe you have a portfolio of stock that needs to be managed. Is there one person in your life that is capable of managing all those areas? Or maybe you need several people, one to be the manager of the business, another to be the manager of the portfolio, perhaps another as the real estate manager, and then is someone on that list knowledgeable about your family in terms of who should get distributions immediately, who might need special issues in terms of their spendthrifts, they have issues like gambling addiction, alcohol addiction, drug addiction. Hopefully none of that's happening. But who is in a position to understand that? So that's something that we should be making sure clients have addressed. Another issue, of course, is trusts. If you are in a state where probate is difficult, you probably are recommending living trusts for your clients. That makes sense. They tend to be revocable. That's fine. But what is the ongoing plan? It's easy to say, well, I'm alive, I'm in control of everything. The living trust is my document, and I will be able to do whatever I want. I'm the grantor, I'm the trustee, I'm the beneficiary. Great. But what does it say about disability? Is there language in that trust that says, should you become disabled, someone else gets to step in as a co-trustee, a successor trustee? That's important to have that. But then the question arises, how do we prove disability? And what I mean by that is, do we need one doctor? Do we need two doctors? Do we need letters? How do we make that the case? Because it's difficult in our current times with isolation and virtual visits and things of that nature. It's difficult to say, oh, mom or dad is ill or disabled. Let's get the two doctors to write letters. Well, we've got to get those doctors to examine mom and dad. Good luck. And then we've got them to write letters. More good luck. These things don't just happen overnight. So we need to make sure that we have planning in place, that the family knows what needs to be done should there be an issue where disability arises. And then what happens with your trust should the grantor of the trust die? What does it say? Some trusts I've seen stop at death. Well, I'm died, says the person, whatever happens, happens. That's terrible. Now you have an uncertain disposition of your property. So you need, in a properly drawn living trust, to make sure that there is a plan beyond the life of the grantor. It should say, upon the grantor's death, this is what I want to have happen. Is there a spouse? Is he or she being taken care of? Are there children? Do children receive property outright in further trust? At certain ages, they'll get dispositions, or maybe never, unless the trustee exercises discretion. All of these things should be addressed with clients. It's basic estate planning. You may have your wealthiest clients going way beyond this and being concerned with the political risk of 2020, with the election coming, with the possibility of significant tax changes in the coming year. But for now, everyone needs this basic planning to be addressed. And so don't assume that just because your client may not have millions of dollars, they don't need you. They do need you, possibly more than ever. An issue that's come up a lot because of the pandemic is the issue of a durable power of attorney. This is a document that everyone should have signed, regardless of their age, regardless of their health. Someone should be authorized to act on your behalf should you become disabled, incapacitated, absent for a long time, and unable to do what needs to be done. There are essentially two types of durable powers of attorney. One is called immediate, the other is called springing. And so the issue is, which one do you want? When you have the immediate durable power, you sign it this morning, this afternoon, this evening, and it is immediately effective, meaning that the person you name as your attorney in fact, that's what we call the person who's allowed to act on your behalf, that person is immediately allowed to act on your behalf. Are you okay with that? Some people say, well, that all sounds good, but wait, how do I know they're going to act if I'm not disabled? Maybe they can just take that power of attorney and take it to the bank and clean out my bank account, or call my broker and say sell or buy or whatever it is that this power lets them do. And so some people say, what else have you got? And I say, well, there is an alternative. It's called the springing power. The springing power says in its document that it only becomes effective, it springs into action when there is proof of disability or incapacity. So how do you obtain that proof if you're the attorney in fact? You go to doctors, because it typically says in the springing power, upon one or two doctors affirming disability, then it's okay for the power holder to act, the attorney in fact, to step in. All right, well, what does that tell us? It tells us we have to find one or two doctors who are going to make a determination of disability, sign a letter. In a pandemic world that we're dealing with, how realistic is that? Sometimes people get ill suddenly and their condition deteriorates quickly. And are you going to find a doctor willing and able to go into the intensive care unit to examine the patient to say, yes, I've seen the patient and he or she is in fact disabled? Well, good luck. That's not something we can just assume is going to happen. So I'm concerned, as I've always been, with springing powers, because even if the doctor signs the letters and say the person is disabled, if you take the springing power to a bank, to a broker, 3 or 4 weeks after the letter is signed, you sometimes run into the question, well, is the person still disabled? This was dated in May or June. Now it's August or September. How do I know they're still disabled? I need a fresher letter. This can drive you crazy if you're that attorney in fact. So my recommendation to my clients has always been, use the immediate durable power. If you don't trust a person enough to sign it and let them have it and know they won't act unless it's appropriate, don't name that person. Some people say, well, I'm not sure anyone can be named. Well, that's difficult. There must be someone in your life that you're willing to trust, your spouse, your children, a sibling, a close friend, a professional relationship that you've had for a long time. Try to find someone. I've often suggested if you sign these durable powers and you're not comfortable letting someone just hold on to them, that's the power holder, give them to your attorney, give them to your CPA, give them to someone that isn't the power holder but that knows you. And so make the person who is the power holder call that person to get a copy of the document if it's needed. And then before the document is given out, have the person holding it try to reach you. And if they reach you and you say, what are you talking about? I'm fine. Don't give out the power. If they attempt to reach you and find out that you're unavailable because you're ill or you're in the hospital, then give out the power. That's probably more extreme than we need to go, but it's a suggestion. Let's now talk about living wills and healthcare directives. Some people don't like these. Some people say, I want medical science to do everything, to turn over every stone to try to save my life. Fine, that's a choice we all can make. Other people say, I don't want extraordinary measures to prolong my life if there is no reasonable chance of quality of life. So which side of that do you fall under? Whichever side it is, whichever side your client is, at least raise the issue of a living will and health care directive. In some states, it's one document where you name a person as the person eligible, authorized to inform medical providers of your wishes. And in some states, in some areas, it's two documents. One is the naming of a person, and the other is the list of things you want done. In some cases, that's combined. In some cases, it's separate. That's not a big deal in terms of which way. Just make sure you know what you want to do. But there's a point you have to be careful of in the document itself. A lot of these documents that are printed forms, boilerplate forms, say you don't want feeding tubes and you don't want intubation. Intubation is what is necessary to insert a respirator in your throat. Well, what happens in that case? Under current planning, under current situations, people affected with the pandemic virus are likely to need intubation in the most extreme cases. And you don't want to be one of 20 patients in the intensive care unit when the doctor says, oh, this one doesn't want intubation, let me go on to the next one. So take a look at the documents that you or your clients have signed and see what it says if intubation is a prohibited or a not wanted factor in the planning here in the document. You may want to change that. You might want to cross that out, just to be thinking in that regard. Another point about living wills and healthcare directives, because of the HIPAA law, the law that says we insist on privacy for people. You are not authorized as a doctor, as a medical provider, to simply tell people about the condition of a patient. So that means that if you have an adult patient, the adult has a right to privacy. Children are a little bit different because children are still the wards of their parents. But let's say your child is over the age of 18, goes off to college, and sadly becomes ill. Will the hospital, the infirmary, the college, medical persons, will they call you and say, we have a problem with your child? Not necessarily, unless your child has a living will or healthcare directive in place. So what we want to do is, I know this sounds awful, but we want to send our children to school with a signed living document that they've signed saying, should I become ill, should something happen to me, my parents are authorized to act on my behalf and receive all information about my medical condition. That way, should there be an issue, should you find out that the child has this issue, you can call the university or wherever the person is and say, I have this document, my child brought it with him or her, and it's in their dorm room, it's in their apartment, I will send you a copy by email, by fax, by some rapid situation, so I can be told what's going on. Does every doctor and every hospital follow the privacy rule rigorously? Perhaps not, but let's not take a chance that the one you deal with will find out what's going on. Another issue in basic estate planning that we should be focused on involves life insurance policies and retirement plans. As we hopefully all know, a life insurance policy and retirement plan do not pass by the terms of a person's will or trust. They pass by the beneficiary designation in that document. So when was the last time your client looked at their insurance policy, their retirement plan designation form? Think of clients who may have been working at the same company for many years. The company may have merged two or three times. The HR department has a different name than it may have had when the client was first hired. Is their retirement plan designation form still findable? And if it is, what does it say? You run into situations in the courts, particularly with retirement plans, where A and B are married, A and B get divorced, B agrees that he or she will relinquish all rights in A's retirement plan. But they don't do a qualified domestic relations order because B's not a beneficiary. B just says, I give up in any interest in your plan. Fine. A then fails to change the beneficiary, and then A dies. And B steps forward and says, well, I'm still named on the documents. I'm still the named beneficiary in the retirement plan beneficiary designation form. I'll take the money. And other people in the family say, no, no, you gave up your right. And the spouse, the surviving spouse, B in my example, says, well, he or she wanted me to be the beneficiary, so I'm still a beneficiary. What happens in that case? There's a United States Supreme Court case, Kennedy versus DuPont Savings Plan, that says the name on the form is what matters. We don't care whether they gave up rights. If their name is still on the beneficiary designation form, they are the beneficiary. In that case, the surviving spouse received the benefit from the divorced spouse that he or she had left, and the stepchildren of the surviving spouse got nothing. So, again, something to be thinking about. Remind your clients to be focused on their life insurance policies and retirement plans. Even if they're happy with the people they named, and that's, let's hope that's the case, should their children be outright beneficiaries or trust beneficiaries? Should their spouse be outright or trust? It could be an issue of tax planning to avoid inclusion in a second estate, or it might just be a matter of reasonable management of assets. Should a person be an outright distributee? Is he or she a qualified and appropriate inheritor of a significant benefit? Or should it be held in a trust where a trustee has discretion? If it's appropriate to make distributions, go there. If it's not appropriate to make distributions, then let the trustee have the discretion as to when and if distributions should be made. So focus on these two issues in particular, because if the client says, yeah, I have a will and my will is fine, well, fine. That covers your probate assets. What about your assets passing outside your will, like your life insurance policies and your retirement plans? I would venture to guess that many clients don't realize that those assets pass outside of a will only in connection with what they say in their own beneficiary designation forms, nothing to do with what the person's will says. Other things to be just reminding the client about: have they chosen the right fiduciaries? As I suggested earlier, we need executors, trustees, if we're using a trust, of course, and we may need guardians if we have minor children involved. Have we made the right choices? Have we examined the ability and the willingness of the people we've named to serve? Have we even told them we've named them? I run into people who say, you know, I named all these people, and I said, well, do they know? No, if something happens, I'm sure they'll step forward. Don't be so sure. People may have their own issues, their own concerns, their own problems in their own lives. These are things you need to be focused on as a planner. And one more point to mention in terms of reviewing your clients' documents and talking about their basic planning. I have clients come to me and we look at their plans and they say, yeah, I signed this form in 1998 or 2001, and it's fine. I have the same spouse. I have the same children. We get along. Everything's fine. Why do I need to even think about changing my document? And then I read the document and it has an article in the document, a clause in the document that says something like, I leave the maximum amount of money that I can be left without federal transfer tax to my children upon my death, and the balance of my assets to my spouse. Well, that's wonderful. But in 1998 or 2001, the children were getting $675,000, maybe $1 million, and the spouse was getting everything else. Today, that same formula says, give the children $11.58 million and the spouse everything else. And the client gives me this quizzical look saying, what everything else? I don't have $11 million to even think about. Well, what's going to happen? You might say, oh, well, they'll all get along. They'll make it work. Don't be so sure. What if the children are the children of spouse A and there's a spouse B who is not their parent? It's a second or third marriage of spouse A. And so they may not be so generous to step aside if spouse B says, well, he or she meant to leave me everything. What's going on here? So these are planning steps that can be taken. None of what I'm suggesting requires you to get into the heavy, sophisticated planning that a lot of us are talking to our wealthiest clients about in 2020, things like SLATs and IDGIDs and all these fancy tax planning techniques that are appropriate for your wealthiest clients. That's a subject of another discussion. But a basic review is a great way in these times and these virtual times to reach out to a broad list of clients and say, when was the last time you looked at your documents? When was the last time you thought about things like your beneficiaries? Do you have all the appropriate documents in place? And if you do not, let's get it done sooner rather than later. Hopefully that's going to be good advice to allow you to be the thought leader for your clients. And even if they've got everything perfectly in place, you've reached out to them, you've rekindled your relationship with them, and you've told them you're thinking about them. That can't be bad in a client relationship situation. So I encourage you to have those conversations. That does bring us to the end of our program on behalf of the PFP section. This has been Steve Siegel. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. I highly encourage you to visit the PFP section website to find my in-depth advisor's guide to financial and estate planning. Stay tuned for Sarah Bradley, who will tell you how to find this valuable resource. Thank you very much for listening.
And thank you for sharing with our community of listeners. Want more information, resources, tools, and guidance on technical and practice management topics? Visit aicpa.org/PFP and check out the show notes for this episode as well. So if you're not already a member, think about joining the PFP section, which is designed to save you time, help you best serve your clients, and take your financial planning practice to the next level. You'll gain access to a robust selection of high-quality technical and practice management resources like guides, 24/7 access to an online learning library, client communication and education tools, up to 8 hours of free CPE, and more. Don't forget to leave us a review so we can continue bringing valuable and relevant content. And subscribe to our podcast channel so you don't miss an episode. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to next time.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA or AICPA.org. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA and AICPA.org are not engaged in offering legal, accounting, or other professional service. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA and AICPA.org make no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and especially disclaim all liability for any damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.